Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Friday. It's Friday. It's so clearly Friday. It's the 29th of August. We are delighted that you are with us. Nothing makes us happier. It's a bit of a rainy day, but it feels good. It's a crispness in the air. We need rain, and by gum, we're going to enjoy it. It will be a beautiful day, no matter what the elements have in store for us today. We look at this 9:14 on this 29th of August, and we welcome you to the proceedings. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'd love to have you be a part of the discussion. It makes it much more fun most of the time. Now, let me go to introducing our panel, which I'm very happy and proud about. They are a wonderful, wonderful group of people who I am thrilled to call friends, and they are just the best, and we are so pleased that they are with us on this morning to talk about the news of the day. Let us begin. Teresa Bourgeois is here. Teresa is public policy and communications expert, and great to have you here.
Delighted to be here. Good morning, good morning. There'll be homework today, so get your pencils and paper out when we're talking about some stuff. Labor Day weekend?
Homework for us?
For
the listeners? Okay. All right.
I want them to look up after the show.
Oh, good.
It's a new semester.
You know, I know this from my years both as a student and as a professor. Nothing kids enjoy more is homework over a holiday weekend. Sign me up.
They can wait till, late in the day Monday,
okay,
just before they go back to school.
All right. That's right? Good.
Just some things they might want to learn about, think about. Labor Day to all the, we celebrate unions, and how did the Trump administration celebrate unions? By last night taking the bargaining rights away from a number of federal workers. So happy Labor Day.
Yeah, and right. we are off to the races.
Right out of the barrel.
out of the gate.
I just couldn't believe that. Here they say, they go on and on about how much they care about Labor Day, and it's going to be a Republican holiday, and then...
I look forward to the homework.
Not the homework.
And I hope you grade on a curve. former EPA and regional administrator, professor at Bennington College, and president of Beyond Plastics, Judith Enck, is here. Good morning, Judith. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. Last night I was at Tanglewood seeing Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Oh, how exciting. With Paul Giamatti.
Yes!
Oh,
my God. And so tune in this weekend. It is a great, great show. If you haven't seen them, as my husband said, wait a minute, you're going to watch a radio show? If you haven't seen them live,
do their
perform,
thing.
You want to go. It's a different experience.
It's very good, and it's a lot of fun. And we've done it over the years with them and without them. They they've done it without us. But it's lovely and very, very fun.
Such a great show.
Yeah. Sundays at 11 here on WAMC.
Yeah, during the introduction.
Saturdays, I apologize.
Saturdays at 11.
Yes.
During the introduction, Peter Sagal said something about NPR, and the whole place erupted with applause and then a standing ovation. And it was so nice. Everyone needed to get it out of them. It was just a really nice beginning.
That's great. Very, very fun. Years ago, when I was there, the first year they ever did it, Peter Sagal got up and he said, welcome, we're here at Tanglewood. He said, here at the home of WFCR. We're here at the home of WAMC. And the place went crazy. And he said, is Shartok here? And he wasn't. He goes, I bet he's probably climbing the fence as we speak. And the place rolled.
He's a funny guy.
Yeah,
that
very,
Peter.
Very, very good. We welcome. we welcome also to the proceedings, a former vice president and the editorial development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick. Good morning, Judy. How are you?
I am fine. I warn the audience. So it's a Friday before a big holiday weekend. So there will be some sort of major news around 4 or 5 mm-hmm. o'clock this afternoon. Could come from anybody, anywhere. But if you're going to break some bad news, this is the day to do it.
Time to do it.
Yes.
It's hard to know what's the bad news? Like, right. Every day feels like a Friday holiday weekend. I don't know. But
it ends with a Y. It's bad news.
It could be, you know, it could be state, could be local, could be federal, but it'll be something.
We'll see.
Guaranteed.
Well, put in your wagers now. See how it goes.
All three.
We're thrilled to have this gentleman on the program. He's been somebody we've been trying to land on the show for a long time. He is a writer, analyst. He recently retired from the presidency of Siena College.
University.
Now Siena University. Were you in on that, of getting it, making it university?
It was part of the strategic plan, yes, that we launched. And, college is now university is flourishing with graduate programs and, you know, I think a really effective arc that's going to take Siena to the next level.
Also an alum.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes, so great. And also, what he's even more proud about, a former New York congressman. His new book is The Spirit of Philadelphia, and it's a great essential read, I would say, especially for the times we live in. And it is a great pleasure to have you back on the program.
Joe, it's awesome to be back and to be with the panelists and look forward to our dialogue. And indeed, I mean, this research, this project I've been on for a couple of years, I think it certainly helped me with my perspective on some of the conflict we're having throughout society and governmental functions. And I look forward to our discussion. Thanks so much.
All right. Have fun with Teresa.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you, Joe. I'm fired up.
Try to talk her off the ledge, Chris. There's your big fish to land. Okay, let's go to.
Oh my gosh.
Let's go to a story that I thought was interesting, just in the name of it. But basically, this idea of what is above politics, and it's from the New York Times. It was on the front page. Who harumphed? Did you harumph?
Me, that was me.
Yeah, well, that was you, Harumph? Okay.
I didn't mean to.
Or a deep sigh, I should say. No, I just found it interesting.
I'm a big sire.
So the story, Trump targets agencies long seen as above politics, critics see big risks. And what I like about this particular story is it kind of puts several stories together and I think gives it a certain context, which I believe these are all stories that we have tackled individually, and this gives us an opportunity to look at them as a trend and see what is happening here. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has long been the place Americans turn to for data-driven information to help make health decisions. The Bureau of Labor Statistics was the source of nonpartisan jobs numbers by which Americans could judge the status of the economy. And the Federal Reserve was the independent central bank that often bucked the short-term demands of presidents with an eye toward the country's long-term economic health. Now, the independence of each of these American institutions is in question after President Trump and a push to root out pockets of independence of government has fired or taken steps to fire the leaders of those agencies and or bureaus. In doing so, critics say the Trump administration is risking the credibility of agencies that were long respected as above politics and play a vital role in providing information needed to guide major decisions about the nation's course. These places are not supposed to be partisan, said Chris Edelson, an assistant professor of government at American University. The biggest danger is the institution loses credibility and people cannot count on it. In a span of a few weeks, Mr. Trump has fired the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics after a less than flattering jobs report. By the way, the woman who was fired from the Bureau of Labor Statistics is going to be speaking, I believe, the week after next at Bard College.
Oh.
So if you get a chance to catch that, that will be very, very interesting.
Suddenly, we are all riveted by the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
Yeah,
and I am now.
Well, I think she has a pretty cool story to tell.
Bard.
Has sought to remove a Federal Reserve Board governor amid a push to gain control of the board and has backed his health secretary's decision to dismiss the director of the CDC over vaccine policies, and we talked about Susan Monterez yesterday, the CDC director, who says she was targeted after she refused to, quote, rubber stamp unscientific, reckless directives. Teresa, would you like to begin?
I'm here, Chris.
Okay, Chris, go ahead.
Well, yeah, it's interesting you're going to have me lead off here because I actually have a broader perspective on this, having just finished this research project. And to me, what really resonates is power. And, you know, what I've learned going back to all the founding documents and also reading about the philosophers who influenced our founders, and then tracing the America's history, our story, if you will, told through the history of ideas, you see a change. In the late 19th century, you see the ether being impacted by new, different ideas coming by way of Europe. This is Hegel and others that and really manifesting in Max Weber, who talks about how bureaucracy is going to help perfect man. And all of this ultimately does impact us here in this country. Woodrow Wilson becomes president. We start to see policy changes. And we move away from a founding idea, which was as human nature was very conflicted. Well, yeah, we have amazing abilities and capabilities, possibilities as humans, extraordinary love, sacrifice if we're called to it. But if we're being very candid, founders certainly felt this, is that we were very conflicted. And therefore, with that conclusion of human nature, we needed to treat power in a certain way. We needed to, wherever we could, decentralize. We needed to separate power, keep it checked, accountable, and transparency was a key piece on this. So, but then in the late 19th century, there is the belief that actually the founders got it precisely wrong. Woodrow Wilson writes this in his dissertation. He says, look, we've really encumbered ourselves. We've done this. We've tied our hands. We have so much possibility if we just take down the separation of powers. His dissertation is called Congressional Government. He envisions something similar to what's going on in Great Britain. All of this starts a path that has really been really unaltered. This arc has been unaltered for the last 125 years. Now, there were moments when we more enthusiastically and more comprehensively embrace this. But here we are today in 2025. I mean, generally speaking, before this era for President Trump, I mean, generally speaking, Republicans, at least some, had principled objections to this, you know, the idea that power should be separated and checked. But that's not where we are today in 2025. I mean, we have really both political parties are not really and this is not meant to be a judgment, but it is just a matter of fact, is both parties actually, for different reasons, do want to consolidate power. I mean, they progressives generally have a idealistic view of human nature that, you know, we can get so much more done that they tend to agree with Wilson, what he said. And then populists actually don't have a principled position on power. That, again, that's not meant to be normative. That's not meant to be a judgment, just a statement of fact. Because what populists say is it depends. If you envision this kind of power that's been exercised in the last year and being done by somebody like President Obama, well, the right-wing populists say, no, no way. But if you're giving this kind of power to somebody, well, like they trust in President Trump, well, then they say yes. And, of course, there are complications and implications when you don't govern by principle, if you govern by personality. So, you know, here we are today, and we're talking about these firings and whatnot. And to me, what's really resonating from my research, from my book, The Spirit of Philadelphia, is that we need to rebalance power. I mean, there's ways Congress can do this, actually. The founders gave Congress pride of place. They're Article I in the Constitution, and they can start by actually sunsetting emergency clauses. I had students ask me explicitly, how is it we read the Constitution? How is President Trump doing this on tariffs? I mean, facially in the Constitution, Article I, Section 8 explicitly gives this power to the people's representatives, to Congress. So how is this happening? And I have to actually explain to them that it actually came from initially law in 1917, backed up by 1977, that was then supported by case law that allowed in emergency circumstances for the president to actually assume these powers. And here we are today in 2025 do we really think we're in some kind of emergency where this shouldn't be worked through and done in collaboration with the people's representatives? So we can sunset laws, we can pass new laws that balance power, but ultimately, you know, this is what I see here today is you got a country so divided that we're not looking at it in the broader perspective. We just say, are you pro-Trump or are you anti-Trump? And then you just sort of separate into your corner and you take your position. I think we need a complete reset and a recognition that those founding principles, and it's not about going back. On the last point, I know I need to yield here, but this is not about going back. It's about actually recovering time-tested principles so that we can go forward together.
But this Congress is not going to exercise any authority. On the drive-in, I happened to listen to Speaker Mike Johnson being interviewed on CNN. And my goodness, talk about not a leader. It sounded like he was just speaking, assuming that Donald Trump was listening to him. And he was asked key questions. The interviewer was great. His district has Shreveport, Louisiana, which has a much higher crime rate than Washington, D.C. And he was asked, you know, do you support sending the National Guard into your community? Oh, that's not my call. And then, oh, it's a Democratic DA. You know, no one wants to hear that. If you've got high crime rate, what is your strategy to deal with it? Question after question. Oh, that's not me. And then he would pepper in, you know, just praises to dear leader. Chris, I think what you're saying is interesting, important, it's historic, but the moment we are in is just so bizarre. And I think it reminds all of us how fragile our democratic institutions are. And just a few days ago, President Trump said he's president, he can do anything. I think he believes that. I don't think the congressional majority is going to step in. The courts have been doing some really interesting work. But then if it gets to the Supreme Court, I mean, that is incredibly divided. And I think the question is power to what end? And I think it's kind of obvious that Trump and his family are exercising power for their own economic gain and not in the public interest whatsoever.
And you know, I really think this is, you know, there are, when you're talking about power, there's rights and responsibilities, right? And that it, when you, it, the question is who you put power in the hands of and what they do with it. And I think what's happening now is you have Russ Vought, and there's two tracks of things that are happening. You have Russ Vought and the Project 2025 Heritage Foundation, but it's really an amalgam of
and
groups.
And Vought is been, now the head
I'm sorry, he's the head of the Office of Management and Budget, but he had been a leader in Project 2025, and there were a whole host of, you know, alphabet soup of public far-right public policy groups who have for a long time put together this effort that will essentially disassemble the infrastructure of our government. And he will say, as will Stephen Miller, who is the president's chief of, what's, I don't know the title.
Destroying for, people. And
right-hand man, right. And also had operated at the fringes in the House and Senate before.
It's not the title, is it?
No. But really.
Deputy Chief.
Yeah. Deputy Chief. I'm not being disrespectful.
I think it's Deputy Chief of Staff.
Chief of Staff. I don't remember what.
I'm a resident racist.
Deputy Chief of Staff. We'll
Thank
go
you
with.
Very much.
Okay, go ahead.
We'll go with that. But what they are trying to do and have wanted to do for a long time is really test the limits of power within the government. And they found in Trump a person who would do that because, as Judith points out, he has his own track about power and how he can amass power to help himself and enrich himself and his friends. And it's a really toxic combination, I think, and made so. But they are testing the limits. But the part of our system that is not working is the Article 1 part, as you say, Chris. The Republicans in the Senate are not, and it only requires 4 or 5 in the House and 4 or 5 in the Senate to do this. They are not asserting their Article 1 powers at all. Sounds very fancy. They're not doing their job by saying that, you know, we have in our Constitution, our structure of government that's worked for a long time, a check and balance on this untethered. And so all of those big fancy words, what it boils down to is then at the Fed, if you do fire the Fed chief, all the experts that I read say, this has global impacts, and you're going to destabilize the dollar around the world, and that is going to hurt people at the kitchen table. If it's going to hurt people's ability to buy homes or invest in their small businesses or a whole host of things. What it means in the real world for people is you destabilize the Centers for Disease Control because you take out the top layer of government, who are public servants. They aren't political people. They've been there for a long time. They have expertise. And that expertise is what got us through the worst pandemic in 100 years. And what will get us through the Legionnaires' disease that I heard news about the other day, and what will keep us, if they're allowed to do their jobs, from getting the next. So for them, it's a big power game. But for people at home, its impact on their everyday lives is traumatic and dramatic. And so rights, people in power are not upholding their responsibilities or their.
Judy Patrick.
So I agree about the testing the limits and trying to accumulate as much power as possible. I mean, and the Trump administration just could wait until May when Jerome Powell's term expires and they'll be in control, but they want to make the case at this point. You know, this move towards like the imperial presidency, I think Schlesinger is the one who wrote the book on that, goes back to Nixon and Eisenhower. So the accumulation of power through executive orders, but you know, executive orders often are only worth the paper they're written on. You know, we talk about the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the CDC. You know, I tended to view, when I was a reporter, these as the boring agencies that you don't want to be the flack for because you never get any calls because nobody's really that interested, because oftentimes they're just so driven by numbers. And, you know, it's so objective about, you know, when you're run by doctors, they tend to be pretty objective, although now I have, you know, you've discovered that there's plenty of wiggle room in numbers. And so I think that, you know, when we talk about balancing power, the system has gotten so complex with, you know, competing case law, with moves by Congress to control spending. I often go back to when I used to cover a city, when a strong mayor form of government, the mayor doesn't have to spend all the money the council allocates. And so the president's doing much the same when he decides not to spend this money that the Congress allocates. So I think it's a real conversation we have about how strong we want our president to be, and almost take Trump out of the equation. We're worried about it because Trump exhibits such dictatorship-like tendencies, but maybe we do really want a very strong president.
But the data is, it may sound boring, but the data is what drives policy, right? The data, I mean, if you look at one of the four people that's out of CDC now, she oversees the data. The data is what you look through to track the spread of disease and how you identify it and how you see if what you're doing is working and how you stop it. The data at the Fed, I mean, that's critical for all sorts of entities to do what they do, to have a common set of numbers that can be trusted. And as somebody was saying last night, the difference between us and Argentina, right, is it's that we don't mess with the Fed. It's apolitical. And if you do, you end up with hyperinflation. You end up with other countries that don't want to invest. You end up because you don't trust the dollar. And so the data is our currency. And of what, you know, it's the basic functions of government. And that's what the Trump administration is not doing. You see it in a lot of different directions. They're not doing the basic work of governing, which includes working with the Congress, working out the differences, finding out where the common ground is, finding out what directions we should go in. But they're dismantling these key components that make our government work.
But data, it depends on what data you listen to. I mean,
so let me just say I appreciate these points. I really listen very intently. Well, I'm actually going to comment about it because I actually think we can get something constructive out of this. And So, you know, let's start with this. I mean, so in the spirit of Philadelphia, what I'm trying to reach everyone, because what I have seen is I've moved around. I mean, we have sorted. We've done a lot of sorting. Like, I can go to rooms, to families, to dinners, and maybe there's 25 people in that room. And depending on what night, I live in Kinderhook. I mean, I may be in a room where there's like 24 out of 25 Trump supporters. Or the next night, I may be in a room where there's 24 out of 25 Trump haters, right? And I listen, and there's like, honestly, I mean, everybody really believes in what they're saying. I mean, so, you know, here today I'm sitting with a group that, you know, obviously are not crazy about Trump, right? And so you really believe you're right. And I'm telling you, I'm in rooms where people who support Trump, I mean, you could put truth serum in them. They just really believe they're right. And what I'm saying is that, listening to your points, I think it's important to recognize the way we arrayed our power in this country, at least at the outset, in the Congress. Congress works for us. This is a republic. And so, you know, when I try to reach, as I'm trying to reach in this book, I'm trying to reach now, let's talk about Trump supporters. I'm trying to reach them. I'm not trying to castigate them. I'm not trying to relegate them to irrelevance. The same thing for people who are anti-Trump. I'm actually saying you're a citizen of the United States, and I'm trying to get people to come to a consciousness that what's going on right now is out of balance. We're out of balance in our public and private life. And so when I try to reach the Trump supporters, what I say to them is, okay, so let's look at the facts. Let's just look at what's happened and how the president now is essentially overturning state decisions, overturning college decisions, overturning private company decisions. And I'm saying, how would you feel if President Obama was doing all of that?
I agree with you.
Yeah.
But I mean, you may know this better than me. Stephen Miller and Russ Vogt have been around for a long time. But they were operating at the fringes of the Republican Party, right? They weren't operating at the center of the Republican Party because their ideas were rejected.
Right.
Right? And what happened with Nixon, right? Nixon exceeded his power, and it's not the Democrats who stepped in. It was the Republican leadership in the Senate and the House. They stepped
in, and they said,
you've exceeded your bounds of authority.
What I'm saying that is I'm looking broader at this. What I'm seeing, and this may even shock you to hear, but what I'm seeing on both ends of the ideological spectrum is aghast. So, you know— So when I say to Trump supporters, I say, how did you feel about President Obama? Oh, my God, it was the end of the world, right? And then I say, well, how about President Biden? I don't know how, but it was worse. And then I say to Trump, people who are antagonistic towards Trump, and I say, what did you think of 2017? Oh, my God, it was the end of the world. What about 2025? Oh, it's the halcyon days. So what I'm saying to you is we're on an arc. We're pulling ourselves further. So here's the key point I want to make on this. Is right now, in 2025, people who are anti-Trump can't imagine a worse circumstance. What I'm saying to you, my research points, is by 2028 and 29, you're going to get a further left and a further right, even though left and right I'm not sure means anything anymore, in a sense that we either have progressive or populist, but it's going to be worse than right now.
Well, if the redistricting happens, it will. But Chris, I wonder if you think so. In the Reagan cycle, like, I disagreed with what Reagan did. I thought it was dangerous.
It's like I just gave Teresa a bone.
Am I talking too much?
No.
But those were policy differences. But you could disagree with Reagan, but you didn't think that he was out to dismantle the. Well, he did. Okay. I'm homeless people everywhere. I'll never forget it.
Let me dive in. You're all making very interesting and good points. But I want to, when we look at the three things that I mentioned, and this idea of being things that were above politics and that was the information that guided us and allowed us. And let's just take the people on the left, let's take the people on the right and put them aside. Are we able, Chris Gibson, are we able to operate as an effective democracy if we do not have that information, that data that is not maligned, that is not altered, and is a true representation of what is happening not for political purposes, but instead to make the best decisions for the people of the country?
No. And so here, and the answer is no. And so here's what I'm saying.
So why did it work for so long, and why doesn't it work now?
There is so much, and I do document this in my book. I mean, right now the mistrust of government is at levels we've never seen. And you can go to Pew. You can. They've been tracking this since the 1950s. And, you know, you can talk about crime stats. You can talk about – there's just like – there is not a common operating picture. So what?
But
my,
that didn't happen by accident. This was a drumbeat of disinformation. I totally rudely interrupted you. Sorry.
Well, no, I just want to say, but see, I'm not going to throw my hands up.
Please,
what I'm saying
buzz
is,
in.
there is a remedy that can be done, and that is Congress cannot fatigue on this, and they work for us. So that's the point. Is that on the matter of the CDC? So what I found is in 1947, when Congress passed the National Security Act that created the Department of Defense, created the CIA, created a number of different bureaucratic agencies, the one thing about that legislation is, in my view, is it over-delegated to the executive. You know, there's a lot of discussion when you get into these kind of spaces about FDR and the New Deal. You know, but actually I found that it really is mixed, that story. I don't think it's all right-wing critique of the left, because there's some legislation FDR passed you could argue was conservative, like Social Security. You don't want, you know, people in their, you know, elder years walking around destitute. That's not good. So what I'm saying is that Congress can use their Article I powers, if needed, to actually pass legislation that says the Congress shall collect this data, and it will be published.
You so, served in Congress. Yes. Did you feel hamstrung at all to make that and allow that to happen?
Well, I can tell you I worked indefatigably on these. Like, for example, I worked on the War Powers Act. I had a bill that had 52 co-sponsors at its height. I was actually stunned.
I don't even mean you personally.
Yeah.
But as a body, did you feel that everyone's on the same page?
No,
of like...
I did not. And I think that that's part of what needs to happen here is I do talk about policy reforms, but I also have a whole chapter dedicated to us, we the people. We have responsibilities in this. So we need to urge, if Congress needs to actually pass a law that collects the data, they're going to have to do it.
It exists.
They're not adhering to it, Chris. There are rules. They're not adhering to them.
Well, what's
that's
happening
what's
right
going
now is the executive has overreached. And this is, again, something
right.
that's been going on for a long time.
It doesn't mean the laws aren't there. It means he's violating the laws. It
no,
means that they're not doing
he
it.
He has. So all these different agencies, is what I'm saying is the latest theory in the Supreme Court is one that I've objected to for a long time, this idea of unitary
executive.
I mean, as a founding principles adherent, I find this really, I mean, abhorrent. But it is what it is. That's our Supreme Court. But there's still mechanisms for we the people to fight back, and that is with the legislative branch. And that's what I'm really here to say is we could throw our hands up and we could get fatigued. I don't think we should do that. I think we should continue to believe in ourselves. I see – when I go to communities – before we went on air, we talked about some of these awesome community events. I think about Greenwich and other places. But, you know, I find people that are still resilient. They're going about their lives. They may not be crazy. Some of them have tuned out. They don't even watch the national news. But they're trying to live their lives with their family and friends. That is a reservoir of will and support for us to reform our republic. Because what's the alternative?
But
we just go to civil war or we quit? I don't think we should do that.
Sorry.
So I want to hear from everybody when we come back. We'll continue the conversation. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we're just going to breathe and yoga, whatever. We'll be back right after this. 21. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday, the 29th of August, 49 minutes past 9 o'clock. Just listening to the music of Buddy Guy. Buddy Guy's new album, Ain't Done with the Blues, and great stuff. And you can check out the playlist where we'll be listing all the tracks from the Buddy Guy album on... at WAMC.org/roundtable. All right, let's go back to the discussion. We do have letters. I want to get those into all of this and having a sort of a vigorous discussion about this. I guess where I don't understand, where I just I'm hearing you, Chris, but I'm here's where I don't I don't there's a blank there that I need to fill in. So if we become, which it seems obviously we are, more and more distant, the sides become more and more ostracized, we become more and more siloed, that then gives us less hope, if you will, for the things that we are talking about to move forward and to have some semblance of order and God knows, maybe even decorum. So, and yet you still seem hopeful that that can happen, and I guess that's the part I don't really get.
Well, so it'll be, so in the process of doing this, I've heard from folks all over the country, because I have a website and you can contact me, and what I've found is interesting, because now, keep in mind, of course, this means real commitment. So you have to read. My book is not a breezy read, to be frank. I mean, it's you got to really lean in. It's like, think of it like a Pilates or a good CrossFit workout, because you're going to be better for it, because there's a lot of philosophy in it, but and history. But at the end of it, here's what's been encouraging. Joe's looking at me. He's like, where's the donut?
No, I like it.
No.
I'm just Googling CrossFit workout. That's all right. Go ahead.
No, but I want to say,
though. It requires rolling tires.
You know, so reason. The reason why I'm optimistic is I have heard, there's a gentleman from Michigan who self-identified as a progressive. He worked at GM. He wrote to me and he said, you know, I feel like I need to be open. I was concerned I was going to be disappointed with your book, but I felt like I needed to try. He actually wrote to me and he said, and I was disappointed. This was his first response to me. He said, you know, I had a problem with the way that you brought God into it. Now, I'm also, I don't want to get into it here, but I mean, I'm actually, you have every right to be an atheist. Absolutely. But at any rate, so he says, this in his correspondence. He says, but I'm going to finish the book. And so I wrote him back and I said, thank you. I just appreciate, we need to do more of this, to listen to each other. He writes me back 2 weeks later. He goes, oh my gosh, I'm like almost 100%. Behind what you're trying to do. And then I want to go on the other side and say that I had a Trump supporter, a very strong Trump supporter, finish the book and actually thought about it and said, you know what, I kind of got lathered up. You know, I do see your point now on power. I was so frustrated. I just felt like we needed to beat those. He called it libs. You know, but the short of it is that what I have found for people who actually take the time, invest the work to read the book and think about it, then they go, we did get out of balance. And so that's why I'm optimistic, because I've reached people who are on these polar opposites and they're actually considering, you know, wow, we really did get off track. I think we can get back on track.
Let me ask you one question, then I want to give this over to the other panelists for a few moments. But I hear what you're saying, but allow me to be cynical for a moment, because, quite frankly, it just looks so good on me. Do we have time for that? I mean, TikTok. I don't think there was a person in here, including you, that didn't mention that this all is very fragile. So fragility brings the fact that it can break and it can shatter in a snap. And I'm just at what you're saying. I understand what you're saying. I am hopeful for is and you know, one reader at a time. I get it. But man, what about tomorrow?
Yeah, no. So here's what I took some kind of hope in too, is that in 1787, when they met in May, they thought their back was up against it too. We just had the Shays Rebellion the year before. States were coining money. They were entering into treaty and security arrangements with other nations. The Articles of Confederation were failing. As a new country, we were concerned we were going to get picked off one by one, that states would enter into alliances with other nations. And actually, this is when they brought forward an entirely new political philosophy. This is common sense realism. It comes with the Constitution. But, you know, many of them thought this could be the last time. They had tried several times. In 1786, they were in Annapolis. But at the end of the day, they took a step back. They finally overcame the large state, small state. This is the Connecticut Compromise. And I argue in the book, it created the spirit of Philadelphia, which is this like coalescing energy. We felt it in our lifetime. If you remember the unbelievable win over the Soviets on the ice, we've had moments when there's something we can't fully put our finger on. but we've come together as a nation. So I still think it's possible.
But I would argue that we now put our finger on a time where it seems, and I agree. So you look at it and say, okay, this happens. We've come together as a nation. I can recall several moments in our history where we've come together as a nation. I learned two things about that. First of all, it doesn't last very long. And second of all, the number of times where it seems like things are falling apart to the point of no return seem to now be gaining more traction and more steam.
I don't deny these things. And I'm hearing the ladies on the panel here. I'm feeling you and hearing you. What I will say is that I think at the end of the day, and Louisiana has come up already today, and California has not, but I'll raise it. One of the things I found is that there has to just be more tolerance and respect.
No.
I think so.
But no.
All right. Yeah. Here we go. Okay. All right. Now, I will say, I just want
to,
before we dive in.
Race watching.
We do have to, we're going to break in about four or five minutes, so we'll start. But when we come back, I promise we'll go right back into it. But go ahead, please.
The policies of this administration are intolerable. Just think where we were a year ago. Would any of us have imagined armed military presence on the streets of our nation's capital, LA, threats that the president says, I don't like Chicago, I don't like New York City, I'm gonna send the military to have an armed presence.
Threats on the lives of
well,
judges.
See, I don't disagree.
But let me just finish my point. Yeah, I'm just getting started.
But you're missing my point. That's the only thing I would say.
I listened and I wanna share your optimism, but I also think we've got to recognize we've got immigrants being rounded up and sent to El Salvador maximum security prisons. About a third of the people that were sent there at a minimum are not criminals, and they are sent to endure. You've got the facility in Florida, which a judge, I'm not going to call the name of it because it's a ridiculous marketing name, a judge says it needs to be shut down. The Trump administration says they're going to fight that. We will all get more COVID in the next few months because of the policies out of CDC. And you know, it's really, the problem is Trump and his sycophants in Congress and the people that serve in his administration. And you think, I just don't think our democracy is equipped to deal with someone like this in the White House. If you are active in your community and you're doing a search for a new school superintendent, would you ever hire Trump for that position? If you're looking for a CEO for your company, would you ever hire Trump? Would you hire Bobby Kennedy to give you medical advice? You have a serious illness in your family. Do you go to a trained doctor, or do you go to a washed-up environmental lawyer, which is what Kennedy is? I mean, the norms are being stretched to the point that our democracy is just not equipped to handle this. And there's a huge amount of human suffering happening and more suffering coming, particularly with, you know, today's the 20th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. Climate change is getting worse. FEMA is being ripped apart. It is as if the plan was to destroy the federal government.
It was the plan. It's in writing.
Yeah, and all of the agencies that, granted, are not always a model of efficiency, but we're working in the public interest. I just don't think our democratic institutions, including Congress and the courts, are up to the task of preventing all of this human suffering and damage.
But the key point I'm making, though,
I just want to say is that, you know, over half the country voted for Trump. He won the Electoral College as well, which is our system. And so my point is that we have to at least respect that people have different points of view. When I talked about tolerance, I'm not talking about tolerating an overreaching federal government. No, as a founding principle conservative, I agree with you on that. This federal government is doing way too much. What I appreciated the candor what Judy said, because what I found in my research is a lot of progressives, when President Obama said to me and others, I was sitting in the audience at one of his State of the Union, he says, you will either act or I have a pen and I have a phone. And half the place stood up and cheered, and half the place said, no, I didn't think that was the right thing to do. But at least Judy said, look, maybe we need a really strong president. And when I talk to populists who support Trump, that's what they too. They agree with you. They want a really strong Trump. What I'm saying is based on my historical analysis, two things. One is we need to take a step back and say, how's this working out? And the tolerance point is not about an overreaching federal government, because actually I share your sentiment. I don't want that. What I believe we need more tolerance is that smaller communities, you know, want, should be allowed some level of decision on how they want to live. We need to move some of that down to the lower level, state levels, rather than trying to have uniform policies. Louisiana wants California to look like Louisiana, and California wants Louisiana to look like California. We have to accept more tolerance.
Okay, so we have to take a break. So I'm going to hold everybody here. We'll breathe deep. I'm going to go look for some Dramamine. We'll be right back after this.
Save a dry stick for a wet day.
Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. And we have this will surprise you. We have a lot of letters.
Are they fired up, ready to go?
They're fired up and ready to go. So here's what I would like to do. I would like just to give each panelist a minute just to wrap up their thoughts. And then I'm going to go to the letters, and then I'll give you time to respond more, because there's other things I want to get to this morning. Is that are you all agreed to the rules?
I think I've spoken enough, so I'll just listen.
Okay, all right, fair enough, Teresa.
I want to respond to something Chris said about how the country is divided, you know, 50-50 essentially, and all, you know, this majority of the people voted for Donald Trump. I agree with you that they did vote for Donald Trump. But I am not sure how divided they are anymore. And what tells me this is Donald Trump called Texas Governor Abbott and said, I need you to find me 4 congressional seats. Donald Trump would not have done that if he felt that he had voters behind him supporting his positions. He is doing that. This redistricting issue is happening because, and they are data-driven, ironically, to the micro-targeting data-driven, and their data must be telling them that they have dramatically lost support. And a reinforcement of that is, what did he say at the beginning of this week? He's going to change the messaging around I hate even to call it the big, beautiful bill, right? That they're not going to call it that anymore. It is his signature legislative thing. Why would they not do it anymore? Because the public doesn't like it. And so, yes, the public is the key here, and the public is responding. They are rejecting what he's doing in Gaza. They are rejecting the way he's going after immigrants in this country. They are rejecting his dismantling of health care. You see it in the Iowa vote, that state vote the other day, where
on Tuesday,
where the state Senate,
state
legislature, but I can't remember which side of the house it was on. I'm sorry. I apologize. I should know that. What is wrong? I know. I listened to her. I looked her up. I can't remember. But she won in a district that Trump had carried by 10%. She won by 12%. That means that people are coming out because they don't like what's going on, and that's what's going to fix this. And the Republicans in the House and the Senate at some point are going to be more concerned about their voters than they are afraid of the attacks that Trump and his funders will make on them. That's the hope to save our democracy.
Judy Patrick. And by the way, it was Caitlin Drew won the special election for Iowa Senate.
Senate. Thank you.
So I do not think the country is divided 50-50. I think more than 50% of people who voted for Trump. That's true.
Yes.
But I think there's a vast middle amount of people who don't care one way or the other. I think they don't pay attention to politics. You know, they like some things, they don't like other things. They pay just nominal interest in the news. I also think there is some role for the federal government. Not every state should make its own decisions about everything. If we believed in that, I mean, the South would still be segregated. Mm-hmm. I think there is a role to play for the federal government in terms of some things need to be federally enforced, civil rights, for example. But I do not believe under this existing political environment and the existing information environment. We are not in the 18th century anymore. This existing Congress going forward, I cannot see for the next 5 to 10 years them having the wherewithal to enact the kind of changes that we're talking about. I do believe that that is the only way forward. But the other thing, I agree with Teresa. The polling numbers show that Trump is underwater in terms of all the overreaching he does. People are concerned about immigration. They are concerned about crime, but crime is the only place where he still is above water.
So and we're going to get to that.
Yeah. So I like the idea of having optimism, but I talk with a lot of Trump people. But they're just marginally Trump people now. You know, they like his style. They think he's got a great sense of humor. They even like his taste in gilding.
He's a very attractive man.
They like his comb over. But they
sorry, that was
they don't dive deep into the policy enough to know about states' rights, to know about separation of powers. They couldn't name the five freedoms included in the First Amendment. So. I think
but
there's.
They know if they lose their health care.
Well, all I know is that CVS yesterday announced that I'm not going to be able to get my COVID shot in New York State because they're not going to offer it at all. Mm-hmm. Because of the new CDC guidelines. Mm-hmm. Even if I meet the requirements, if I'm over 65 or I have one of the pre-existing health conditions, so it's going to make that COVID shot harder for people to get because you're going to have to make an appointment with your primary care doctor if you have one. And good luck, you'll have to wait 6 to 8 months for it.
Can we go to Vermont?
No.
It's 12 or 14 of the states. I can't remember which ones they were doing it. They may have modified it overnight because there was a lot of blowback over that. But, I mean, maybe Walgreens will do it. Maybe Hannaford will do it. I mean, but CVS...
No, they can't get reimbursed. They're not going to get paid for it.
Right, but you can if you're over 65. But CVS, they're saying, no, I'm not going to even go there at this point.
Judith, would you like a minute?
My short answer is we're all going to get COVID a lot, and a lot of people are going to die because of these CDC policies. My long answer is I don't think our democracy is equipped to handle this moment. I don't think we have checks and balances. I think... to say that Trump is overreaching is an understatement. He is amassing power for his own economic gain. We're beginning to look like regimes in other countries. I don't know if you saw the photos outside of the U.S. Department of Labor. The building named after Francis Perkins is a gigantic picture of Trump. A big banner. We're going to see more and more of that, more military parades down the streets of Washington, D.C., more armed military presence in our communities. And I just, Congress is not going to stand up to him. Some of the federal courts are, and then you get to the Supreme Court. And I just think the human suffering is going to continue to be immense. Whether it's EPA saying climate change doesn't exist anymore or Bobby Kennedy making medical decisions not based on science. The suffering is going to continue and it's going to be worse.
All right. I want to get to letters and we'll rip through as many as we can and then we'll move on to other subjects. And feel free, just keep your responses short, panelists, but... please feel free to comment on any of the letters that we get.
Or just sigh.
I mean, you can express yourself however you wish. Norman says, Trump voters didn't vote to lose their medical insurance, SNAP benefits, radio stations, school and library funding, and the rest of Project 2025. Wrong, says Mary Beth. Only 31, John McLaughlin moment. Wrong. Only 31.8% of populace voted for Trump. We need more tolerance like we had it. Tolerance for women, people of color in positions of leadership and power. We are slipping backwards since January 20th, 2025. It's actually been more of a slip and slide, that from Mary Beth. We go to Bill. I think Chris is saying that both the right and the left think and believe they are right, and that keeps us stuck. Granting space to the other's thinking does not mean you agree with them. It does allow space for something else to happen rather than just more of the same. Does that pretty much?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and exactly. I think that's a keen insight.
We go to Andrew. Our democratic republic was created with checks and balances. Once the checks and balances are no longer in place, all the protections the founders put in place no longer exist. And if so much of the population thinks Trump and Project 2025 are what is right for the country, we have already lost the democracy. If only we could have educated American children to be able to think critically for themselves in time. We go to Rosemary, who says, we survived several times, yes, but in 1776, there was no internet, there was no social media. This changes everything. Marion says, the panelist says we must respect that people have different points of view, but every Trump voter I talk to is grossly misinformed and bases their point of view on lies and right-wing talking points. Do I have to respect that? At the doctor's office this morning, wow, you've already been to the doctor, good for you, a man said at least Trump wants peace. Putin will listen. Zelensky is hated by his people and no respect because he wears a T-shirt in the White House. You get my drift, says Marion. We go to Sarah, who says Trump won 30% of eligible voters, not more than half of the country. Then we check in with Lisa. What your guest is ignoring is that the GOP in Congress and MAGA cult members are unwilling to disagree with Trump on anything. They never admit he's wrong. With every other leader, we could say, I support him, but I don't like this action or that policy. But Trump demands and has been granted 100% fealty. Congress isn't going to pass laws to rein him in. That seems like a fair point.
Well, you know, I hear this, but let's also remember that, you know, they're trying to win. They think that these members, I served with them, that they think they want to be reelected. So it's not, I know it seems like they're just doing it because Trump's telling them. They're doing it because they think it's their way to win re-election. And I think that's where we the people, and, you know, these sentiments about some of these policies that are working against people who voted for Trump, when people actually express that, when they stand up, I mean, that's what will make a difference. And you've actually even heard folks like Steve Bannon say, do you really want to go after, you know, food stamps in this way or Medicaid in this way, because those voters actually came out and they voted for you. So he does have some voices that are trying to give pause or at least consideration, more full comprehensive consideration as to what needs to be done. So, you know, the last thing on this, on these percentages things, I hear this. I don't dispute this 30%, 30, but here, let's remember this. That's the way our system works. So, you know, if we're going to undermine that too, I mean, we do have a republic. People have a choice. You're not required to vote. You're strongly encouraged to vote. But if you don't vote, well, then, you know, that's going to impact the final result. So I think what's actually constructive at this point is to get more people involved in the process, expressing how they view these new policies. And you know, Trump, to last point on Teresa's thing, is that historically, of course, presidents don't do well in midterms. And you're right. Trump is data driven. So you have the historical patterns and then you have his own polling. And I think he's concerned. I think he's concerned he's going to lose.
But that's why he's trying to change the rules.
That's why he wants to change the rules. But people have to see that not. I mean, I want to wake people up to say this is his fear is good news for us because it shows. I mean, him calling Texas, that's not a position of strength. That is a position of profound weakness. Reverend Barber gave it I thought it was an amazing speech about a week ago from North Carolina, Pastor. But he pointed out, which one of these writers did, which is Trump got 30% of the overall vote. But that means there's an awful lot of people who aren't voting. But these policies are going to impact their lives, and can we encourage them to vote? And that's what Obama did. Obama brought out enormous numbers of people who've been on the sidelines. And so it's not just changing the minds of Trump voters. Their minds are already changing. But it's also, Judy, the people that you were talking about who just aren't engaged, when their lives are impacted by these changes, and they will be at the pharmacy when they can't get COVID shots, when their parents get COVID, when the people around them start dying of COVID again, they're going to be impacted by this, and that will cause them to vote.
Let's go to just a couple more letters, and then we'll move on to other topics. Teresa says, the truth is not in the middle. Our democracy is being overturned. That was a different Teresa, by the way. Russ says, the founders were most apprehensive of faction, of the tyranny of party. This is our current challenge.
Yeah.
Then we go to Ellie. Teresa is 100% correct. She said that the extreme Republicans, quote unquote, wanting to test the limits of executive power are found in Trump a willing player, because for Trump, it's never been about government. It's about using the power of government for personal accolades and retribution, feeding his narcissism and amassing wealth for his family. It is just wrong to say that Trump is a strong leader. He is a strong puppet of the extreme right. Then, and we'll probably end it here, go to Joan, who says, Chris Gibson should be a regular on the roundtable. I think you are going to be.
I hope so.
Should be a regular in the roundtable. He speaks with real knowledge and a substance, as well as vision for our future. I feel hopeful listening to the remarks. All right. We will pause there as far as got to most of the points that were
great letters.
Cross-section of letters in the email this morning. Okay, so let's turn to other issues. We've got a few minutes. We can kind of set up this topic, and then we can get into it on the other side of the break. By the way, Teresa Bourgeois is here, Chris Gibson, and Judy Patrick, and Judith Enck. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. All of that from just one story so far. So let's go.
Oh, no.
All right. We have also talked a lot this week about sending the National Guard to various cities in this country. We have seen what has been happening in Washington, D.C., in the District of Columbia, and the back and forth, meaning the debate over that. Now, there have been calls for sending the National Guard, as well as ICE units in connection with the National Guard, to other cities in the country. And it seems that the city of Chicago is the next up on the list, although Baltimore also has been mentioned in other U.S. cities. So I just wanted to bring up two things. One is about crime rates. And this is not to say I'm not just looking for a talking point here, of because we so often have heard that Trump is doing this as crime rates are down. But what I wanted to look at more is, you know, is that what does that mean? What exactly does that mean? Chris hinted to this earlier. President Trump, a move to take over policing in Washington, D.C. to, quote, rescue our nation's capital from crime. But the data doesn't back up many of his claims. Murder and violent crimes dropped significantly across the U.S. last year, a trend that's continued so far in 2025. The crackdown comes even as his administration cut funding for other kinds of crime prevention work. And I think that is what we should be looking at, too, is that while the data may not back up many of his claims, murder and violent crimes dropped significantly across the last year. But the federal law enforcement crackdown comes even as the administration cuts funding for other kinds of crime prevention work. And when you look at this of where we are, we're finding that many communities that had outreach programs, many communities that had programs both in the streets of our biggest cities as well as in urban areas that have been operating for 15, 25, 35 years, working with the prison population, working with drug and those addicted to drugs and alcohol, that a lot of that funding has been cut now for those programs. The progress is in jeopardy as the Justice Department terminated almost $170 million in grants for CVI, which stands for
Community. It's a community policing programs where community groups work with law enforcement to, and I'm sorry, I can't remember what VI stands for, but it's a core program that
I just couldn't find it all.
It's
community violence intervention.
I should have known that. I'm sorry. Okay. Community violence intervention, but these are proven effective programs where police work with community groups and to try to de-escalate or deter violence.
So there's that also. And then let's throw in, since we have time just before I go to a break, and then we'll discuss this, which is same thing, the Trump administration / federal funding for gun violence prevention. We saw another school shooting this week in Minneapolis, and the Trump administration has terminated more than half of all federal funding for gun violence. I would like to take a look at those numbers and what we take from that, as if we are saying that if the president is saying our cities have gone to hell and the programs mm-hmm. that have been put in place to try to address that have been eradicated, what does that mean for the future? Because quite frankly, we haven't even seen that yet. Mm-hmm. So we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We will hear from our group. We'll want to hear from you as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Judy Patrick, Judith Eng, Chris Gibson, and Teresa Bourgeois will continue our conversation after this news from the BBC.
The rockers and the high rollers shall stage it with them all. Kings, queens, and presidents, I've seen them come and go.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Teresa Bourgeois, Chris Gibson, Judith Eng, and Judy Patrick. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Just before the break, I tried to set up the segment to talk about some of these issues in dealing with both crime rates and gun violence in our nation's cities, as the administration is putting troops onto in an effort to rescue our cities from crime, and looking at the data and looking at the programs that are in place and also the programs that have been cut, in some cases deeply cut or eradicated, and what that means for future numbers as we look at this as an overall problem in our cities. Teresa Bourgeois.
So I think that the Trump administration is sending in the National Guard and others into our cities. And by the way, over $1 million a day is the price. That's not the cost. The cost is a lot higher, but the price is over $1 million a day for what he's doing in D.C. And they're doing it because they want to try to regain the anti-crime, we are the crime people, we're going to protect you from crime message, because that's a powerful one in elections. I think they're doing it because they want to normalize the use of military in our streets, which is not something that we do in the United States of America, but it's something they're doing now. They've created this very well-funded ICE domestic, essentially a military force, but they're going to need to, he thinks that maybe they need to layer that in. So they want to normalize this, which should not be normalized. And I think the third thing is they're trying to distract from all the things that are going wrong, from the Epstein situation, from the tariffs that are really taxes on consumers, and they're beginning to realize that, from Gaza, from Ukraine, from a host of other things. But so the Democrats have responded by saying, some of the governors, thanks, but we don't need you. I think that we have to change that response. The response is, the Republicans are defunding public safety. The Trump administration, in a variety of ways, and Joe pointed out a number of them, are defunding those things that make us safe. There are three core things that the people need. They need economic security, they need health security, and they need feel personal and community safety. And the Trump administration, in fact, is destabilizing our economic security. They are defunding and destabilizing our health security. But something that's not being talked about enough is what they're doing with our public safety. How are they doing that? Already, as Joe said, they froze funding for these community anti-violence programs. They froze funding for domestic violence programs. U.S. police officers, one of the most dangerous calls they go on are domestic violence. There are funding to have police officers work with community-based groups, like in this area, it's Unity House, to address in a comprehensive way domestic violence, stop those programs. They have defunded the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and changed a lot of the rules, and that is with gun violence issues. They have defunded, they have cut funding for FBI agents. There are a whole series of things. If you listen to the mayor of Baltimore, what he says is, you know what I need? Yes, I'll call you up and tell you what I need, President Trump. I need you to send me back those FBI agents. I need you to send me those DEA agents that you cut. I need you to have these to stop freezing funding for our community-based anti-violence programs that are working. And not only did they freeze these funds, cut these funds, weaken these law enforcement arms, if you look at what's in their budget that they need to pass by October 1st, deep, deep cuts, $1 billion across 40 departments of and DOJ of grants that support police departments and reduce violent crime. And I'm reading here from a list that's been put out. $646 million from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, Violence and Terrorism Prevention. $545 million they want to cut from the FBI in its workforce. They want to cut $430 million for cybersecurity and infrastructure security, $468 million more in the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. They want to dismantle that and move it into the DEA, Drug Enforcement Administration, which is the fever dream of the gun lobby. This is, at the behest of the gun lobby. It goes on and on and on. $170 million for the Bureau of Indian Affairs for Public Safety. They want to cut deeply into those rural anti-violence programs that are proven to be very effective. There's a whole part in the proven effective anti-violence programs for urban areas that they have funded, and that they had a program to share that information with other communities, wiped it out. They have frozen it. They want to wipe it out. I can go on and on. Other people need time to talk. But the Republicans are defunding public safety. And we need to hear that message from mayors across the country. We need to hear it from police officers. We need to hear it from sheriffs. We need to hear it from governors. Because that's the reality of what's going on. And it's going to get a lot worse if they get the cuts that they want. And they're in the House bill, House Justice bill, Appropriations bill. They're not in the Senate bill yet. But that's what we need to wake up and pay attention to. Okay, soapbox over. Not over completely, but I just need to let other people
talk. I appreciate that Teresa brings the receipts. And I think the points are essential and proves that this administration is not really interested in governing. They're interested in the show.
And dismantling the government.
And the show is armed military presence only in cities that Trump doesn't like, that are run by Democrats, often people of color. You know, you look at the statistics, the top U.S. cities with the highest crime rates are places you don't really hear Trump talking about. Memphis, Tennessee, Oakland, California, St. Louis, Baltimore, Detroit, Alexandria, Louisiana, Cleveland, and New Orleans. I've only heard Trump in Tom Honan, because I think a lot of this is immigrant related, talking about, of course, L.A., San Francisco, Chicago, and New York. And it blends into their oppressive immigration policies because, you know, Trump says we're only going to go after hardened criminals. That's certainly not been the case, particularly with ICE having quotas. And so you've got these sweeps going on where people often because of the color of their skin are being targeted. But again, if you look at the numbers, immigrants commit far less crime than American-born residents. And so it's not fact-based. It's more philosophical. I think it's very driven by Stephen Miller. And the bottom line is a lot of this is a waste of money, and it's not going to work. I mean, if the president was serious about public safety and crime, he would have conversations with the mayors and the governors and say, what do you need?
And he'd stop cutting the programs that they know that work. Sorry,
yeah, well, he's cutting the programs and he is inflaming constituencies. Guns play a big role. This week, the tragedy in Minnesota, to hear elected officials still saying it's time for thoughts and prayer. These kids were praying at Mass in a Catholic church, and they were gunned down. And to just repeat that line, that the problem is it doesn't solve the issues.
Mental health. That they said, well, we know that this is a mental health issue. They're cutting the funding for mental health programs. Right. So if they think it's the guns, I mean, it is absolutely the guns. But for those who say it's mental health and there is a mental health crisis, they're cutting funding to address that mental health crisis. Look at Gabby. Here's some homework. Gabby Giffords, Giffords.org. Go to her website.
The homework part. Yeah.
Yes, this is a homework. Giffords.org. She had a statement on Trump going into D.C. with links on how they're weak on crime. Look at that. Go to the Council on Criminal Justice. It's a bipartisan group. They have a list. Look at what they posted in May 2025. See how they are undermining efforts to address crime.
And the Cato Institute has really important numbers on immigrant crime rates versus American-born crime rates. So the whole narrative of immigrants causing crime problems is just not the case.
Judy.
So crime is such a political football. And looking at crime stats can be a political football as well. I mean, you compare rates from one year to another, but you look at historical trends. We tended to look at violent crime rates. I mean, in many cases, it's a matter of perception. When I worked in Schenectady, we had a great crime reporter, and we covered a lot of crime stories, and they were in the newspaper. And so people may have gotten the mistaken impression that there was a lot of crime in New York City. I think that's what happens out in the hinterlands. People watch the news. Mm-hmm. Crime is very easy to report on. You get the sense that there is a lot of crime. So what the real nature of crime is hard to measure. It doesn't really matter, actually. One person murdered is one person murdered. Crime matters for everyone. We worry about property crime. We worry about domestic violence. You know, we talk a lot about, you know, federal grants and state grants to localities. But in my time, I have seen good work done by these federal grants. I also have seen wastes of money where you send, you know, military grade equipment to a small town in, you know, Fulton County. Mm-hmm. That's a waste of money. Mm-hmm. They poured tons of money into, you know, domestic violence programs. Have I ever seen any statistics about whether or not domestic violence is actually down in those towns? No. So it's such a complex issue, and it's easily manipulated by either side. And But the idea of military, a paramilitary force on the street, no, don't like it, don't want it, want it to end.
So a couple things. I'm going to address first what Judy just mentioned as far as paramilitary and also the National Guard, the specter of more National Guard deployments. I want to bring some facts and clarity to that subject area. And then I will engage in the politics of crime. I'll follow that up from some of the comments from panelists. First, the Guard. And the paramilitary. So two different issue areas here. First one is the District of Columbia, and then the others are states and cities within states. So as I think everyone knows, there are different stipulations for these two different categories. There is more constitutional and legal and court law that supports executive involvement in the District of Columbia. But there are limits there as well. As far as taking control of that police force, there's a 30-day stipulation on that. So, you know, on the whole matter of what is the appropriate level of direct federal involvement, I'd say that, you know, Trump and the Trump anti-Trump side, they're going to have their talking points. I'll get more into politics in a second. But I think what we all have to do is watch the law and what the stipulations are, insist on following the process and the law. That's D.C. On the states, so it was mentioned as far as the governors are concerned and city mayors as well. So the law on this is, generally speaking, there has to be a request from the governor or the mayor for help. There is an asterisk. And the asterisk is if the president declares an emergency for the safety of federal officials and federal buildings, then the president, court held up by the Supreme Court, can deploy, but there's a very narrow focus of that federal deployment. It is, in fact, at that point, the federal officials and the federal building. So in this moment of heightened tensions, political now, that I think we need to stick to what is the law and insist that the law be followed. Now let's move to politics.
But did they follow the law in L.A. and California?
Well, you know, again, the courts started to step in on that, and the administration – well, to answer your question, what's interesting about this – and I don't want to get sidetracked because I want to make my 2 points and then we can dialogue. But what's interesting is President Trump did not initially want to answer the question. He eventually did. And I think that is because – and I think he would be – I think he'd even say it. He is interested in pushing the boundaries. He wants to really expand his power. By the way, he, in his own mind, he thinks there's nothing wrong with
he
that.
He said, I can do whatever right. I want. I can stay there longer than 30 days if I want.
So he
That's
initially
not the
did
law.
Not answer the question because the reporters were asking him, are they here to protect federal buildings and officers? He wanted to keep that ambiguous because he liked the idea of more maneuver space if he wanted to get involved in things that are explicitly for states and for city law enforcement agencies. So, but I think reporters in this case did their job because they really pressed him and eventually had to say, no, it's about the federal buildings and it's about the federal officers. So that is – and it's important to me as a founding principles conservative that any administration, Obama administration, Trump administration – regardless, they follow the law, the Constitution and the law and the court law. So that's that. On the politics of crime, you know, so interesting. A lot of interesting comments here. I want to build on some of this. Judy did mention a little while back, about an hour ago, she said, look, Trump feels that crime is actually one area where it's positive for him. Keep in mind, he's not only doing it for now, like that is to say August 29th, 2025. He's looking forward. I think he does feel concerned about the historical focus on midterms that generally the party in power loses. He's also concerned about some of his policies. He's trying to change verbiage. But he's also – he's looking forward. And he's seeing Mondami. He's seeing New York City. And he thinks he's going to benefit from this.
He's trying to position himself
exactly.
as being good on crime.
Now,
but his policies are not.
I actually want to compliment you.
Sorry,
what I'm trying to say is what, this is what Trump is doing. He's in this game now, but he's looking forward. What I want to say is when I listen to you, Teresa, I'm recalling my experiences of formidable political opponents circa 2008. And then when I was still – and then when I left the Army in 2010. So the two that come to mind are especially David Axelrod and Rahm Emanuel. When I say formidable opponents, I'm like, okay, I may not agree with you, but that's a very compelling – construction of an argument. You started to – so where I'm going with this is if you look at the data, and it does – a lot of it depends on public opinion data on how you ask the question. But it is true what Judy's saying, that Trump still views this as one of the areas that he's strong. And looking over the horizon with New York City, he thinks this is a go-to issue. So he's framing it. However, if you think about 2008, you know, actually McCain was still ahead by a couple points – up until the crash, the stock market crash, Obama has a decisive victory in 2008. what Axelrod was able to convince candidate Obama and the Democratic team is really questioned, you know, in core issues that Republicans view as their issues, whether it be you talked about physical security, you talked about economic security. Republicans generally think they run strong. Axelrod said, let's question that. Let's go after that. And they said, well, if this is competence on physical security, then how do you explain Iraq? Right. And then if you guys have economic competence, how do you explain the Wall Street crash? Right. So I'm just saying I found that formidable as somebody who left the who retired from the Army, ran for Congress. And then Rahm Emanuel, also very effective in his candidate recruitment and his messaging. So what Trump has not felt is pressured on this issue. So this is an issue he's vulnerable to. Because, you know, and this used to frustrate my troops in Iraq, is we would do so much work to bring security to, say, Tal Afar, where that campaign, where we worked for Colonel McMaster and the 3rd ACR in Nineveh Province. My troops were like, we've made them safe. Why don't the Iraqis feel safe? And when I explained to my troops, I said, look, the perception of security is at least, if not more important than security. So when the Iraqis felt secure, then they actually formed neighborhood watch groups. They turned in the people digging in their street with IEDs. Right. And so this issue of the perception of security is where Trump thinks he's actually most ascendant. So when I heard you list a whole bunch of facts in terms of how federal and state officials can work together, some collaboration programs, what I'm suggesting is that and Republicans, they'll have a whole take. I'm not gonna here to do this here today, but they would actually push back on all this that you're saying. What I'm saying, that my analysis is that this is an issue that can be battled on both sides of the issue. The fact that he's pressing this tells you he likes his chances, especially what's going on in New York City. But at the end of the day, there is enough people, at least in the middle, if you will, that if they don't feel safe, they're not going to say they're safe. And they're, and if they don't feel economically secure, they're going to say they don't feel economically
well,
secure.
But the one of the reasons why they may feel less safe is because the Biden administration had Bipartisan Safer Act, right? And there was a whole bunch of initiatives that helped reduce the crime rates. They're not gone. There is crime. There will always be crime. But they were coming down, and we know what to do about it. And they have undermined those efforts. The Trump administration, with the Republicans being complicit in this and voting, have undermined a broad range of tools to deal with crime. And Judy, about reporting, yes, you reported crime when it happened. But what we need to have is stories about how do you really prevent crime. I met a guy the other night from Albany, John Scott. I don't know much about him, but he runs his program called The Fourth Generation. And Senator Pat Fahey and Paul Grundell from the New York Writers Institute, local people, they're big fans of his. What is he doing? He's doing the hard work of working in schools, programs with people in advance of the school day, at lunch, after school, STEM programs, ways to engage young people, particularly young people at risk. That's the hard work of violence prevention, having U.S. Marshals and DEA agents and others that work with cities, with police departments, as we did in Boston. I spent 3 years on anti-violence programs. It's 5% lock 'em up, 95%. Get jobs, clean up the local parks, you know, deal with young people, engage people. You don't cut library funding. You don't cut health care. I mean, that's all adds to crime. But Democrats need to regain the crime.
So, and on that point, so when if you look at how the governor's race went here, it was a surprise in 2022. So you had the Zeldin campaign saying, look, there's an issue with crime. And of course,
well, he's got an issue with forthcoming, by the way, on EPA. But Judith can talk about that.
I do want to say, though, I'm trying to make a point that I think could be helpful to this whole dialogue, mm-hmm. is that Zeldin made this point that the counter from the left was, no, it's all the data is going down. And so that may be even, I'm not here to say one way, that what I am telling you is that this perception of security, people felt like they mm-hmm. weren't heard.
I agree with you. Absolutely.
What I'm saying is what was effective in 2008. In 2010, is they got veterans, they got police officers come out and to say what their experiences were and how they felt. And if in 2026, if police officers come out It's one thing for you to say that, and it's important to a number of people. But if you want to win over independents, if you can get police officers to come out and say, look, we made inroads on these programs, and then those, that could be formidable.
A very close friend of mine ran a program in New York State for 10 years, Meredith Wiley, who I know you interviewed, called Fight Crime, Invest in Kids. And she did that. She organized sheriffs and police chiefs and law enforcement people and police unions all around the state to advocate for these types of programs that work with police to try to reduce crime. But that's why I want homework. I want people to look at the Council on Criminal Justice group, look at the Brennan Center website, look at the Giffords website about what's being defunded, and speak up about it. We need to hear from mayors. We need to hear from police.
We have 90 seconds.
I'd like to see more on white-collar crime.
Yeah.
And all the financial problems in corporate America and reducing IRS auditors. Of course, I think everyone in the political spectrum wants to feel safe. We all know someone who's been a victim of violent crime or ourselves. But, you know, the difficulty here is the Trump administration doing more performative work than actually governing. But I am serious. I never hear Trump talking about corporate crime or, you know, look at all the money he's making on cryptocurrency. That needs regulation.
Right.
And there is a major deregulation effort underway there.
Or environmental crimes.
Oh, yeah, that.
All right. Anybody else? Okay, we're out of time. My thanks to the group this morning. A good, vibrant discussion. I thank you all for it. Teresa Bourgeois, Chris Gibson, Judith Enck, and Judy Patrick. You're all wonderful. I hope you have a beautiful holiday weekend. Spending time here this morning means the world to me. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the opportunity.
We'll be back right after this.